My next guest has sort of made it his life's work to put an end to that. For almost four decades, Krista Rose has been a leader in the animal rights movement, an inspiration and consultant to countless individuals and groups dedicated to the animal cause. In 1984, he founded Last Chance for Animals, LCA, which is an international nonprofit animal advocacy organization focused on investigating, exposing, and ending animal exploitation. You might know him from some of the TV and movie roles he had. He was an up-and-coming actor, seemingly bound for stardom when his life took a detour. He tells the story in his book, In Your Face, and that title should tell you a lot about the approach he takes to animal issues. I've been around animal welfare and animal rights issues and stories for a long time. There are some who talk the talk, and there are a few who walk the walk, and he is definitely in the second category of those. We'll be right back and start our conversation with Krista Rose right after this on Coast to Coast AM. You know, what happens to animals happens to us, and people who dismiss animal cruelty as something that really doesn't concern them, they're not paying attention. I mentioned at the start of tonight's program what's happening with the coronavirus, now believed to was born in these horrific Chinese meat markets where dogs and pigs and snakes and all kinds of wild game animals are crammed together in what amounts to like a petri dish of disease and filth. And then people eat these animals and they wonder why they get sick and how diseases like coronavirus or SARS are born. That involves us. That's a human health issue as well as an animal cruelty issue. And it's the kind of thing that Krista Rose has been going after for a long time. He's worked as an actor on stage, in films and television. He's been a cop, a bouncer, a private investigator. He's a martial artist. Chris, it's a life well lived, and you're not even close to being done. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, George. Yeah. I spent some time in China a year and a half ago, and then every year I go back to South Korea. But in China, they have these, and South Korea and Seoul as well, where we have an office. They have these markets, these live, some of them are called fish markets, but they're really all kinds of animals, including dogs and cats, domestic animals, and what have you. It's not a wonder that you see diseases coming out of this place. If you saw how filthy and how bad and how cruel these places are, it's mind-boggling to even think that things worse than the coronavirus don't happen, and happen sooner. People are eating live animals. They're eating them while they're alive. They're certain fish they'll eat while they're still alive, and they're just being filleted. And you see this, and you see dogs being boiled alive, cats being boiled alive, electrocuted, just executed in so many different ways. And to think that this goes on all over China. I try to make it a real point to boycott anything that's even made over there or anything, because, there's no reason that the Chinese government allows it to continue. The younger Chinese generations, there's a big middle class going on over there. There's about 500 million people in the middle class. And a lot of them, the first thing they start to do is they buy dogs. And unfortunately, they're usually purebreds, and they buy them from breeders. But the thing is that they do get dogs, and a lot of these people are having their companion animals stolen by thieves to butcher them for the dog market, the dog meat trade. It's called DMT, or dog cat meat trade, and it's big, it's prolific, it's all over China. People think it's just going on in Yulin and southern China for that week. No, it's going on all over China, and it goes on all year long.
And it goes on all over the world, too. I mean, when you look at the factory farms, I mean, we'll get into some details that what goes on here in the meat production industry. If people could see how it's made, they'd stop eating it. I think that was true. I certainly know a lot of people for whom that's who've been confronted with the evidence of what goes on, and they stop once they see it.
You hit it right on the head. It's prolific here. This is one thing that it's hard to argue over there, because they say, well, you eat turkey, you eat cow, you eat chicken, And it's hard to argue. All I can say is, no, I don't. And but it, you know, to them they call it culture, and you know, and it's funny how they can separate what's one is food and the other is pet. You know, they can make a clear delineation on that. And but you're right, our factory farms here are just as prolific and just as horrible. And anybody that's ever gone into a factory farm would see the suffering, and it's just in such mass numbers. And I've been in piggeries, I've been in dairy farms, I've been in henneries where they got hens and chickens where they're laying eggs. There's different types of chickens, you know, there's those that lay eggs, there's those that raised just a few weeks just to be broiler hens. And to think that you pay $5 and you get a chicken and it's the life of a bird, that's pretty disgusting. And, you know, I've been vegan now for, it's going on 41 years. And I still box. I box 3 days a week. And I'm not lacking anything, that's for sure. And I could box better than most guys in the gym, and I'm older than them, so it's we're seeing more and more awareness to becoming vegetarian or vegan, and I don't really care what reason people become vegan, just as long as they do, just because of the suffering of the animals. And and I'm not a sentimental pushover kind of guy. I've never had a dog or a cat, so it's not like an animal issue. It's just a matter of, you know, it being why make something suffer for your palate when you don't have to? These days, you definitely don't have to. So it's but it's a lot of suffering going on in there. And these factory farms are all over the country, all over Canada. And they're prolific. So, and the way you could help if you care at all, in any way, to care about your health, or your environment, or you just care about the animals, you gotta do is just change your diet a little bit, and it's and you save thousands of animals in your lifetime. You will save several thousand animals.
You know that today is Monday. We're now past midnight. It's Monday. Meat-free Monday is something that a lot of activists, Paul McCartney is one of them, has pushed that. And I, you know, it's important, I think, you know, and I've dealt with animal issues for a long time. You don't want to try to lecture people about what they can't eat, but you can give them some guidance. Meat-free Monday is a way that you just make one day a week where you stop eating meat, and it can make a big difference, and then you get used to it, and it's
Well, that's it. You hit something right on the head, too, and that is you can't lecture people into it, you know. And I just normally I don't even never mention it, but I just lead by example. And, you know, and then when I'm out to dinner with people, I always prefer to go to a vegan restaurant just to give them the support. But if I'm in a regular restaurant, I just make a point that my dinner will be vegan. And then other people will start asking me questions, why? What, don't you need your protein and all this? And they just answer the questions. And they just barely answer the question, and then it makes them want to ask more. And they become interested. I've had friends who, Nick Solosi, he used to bug me all the time about being vegan. And one time I didn't see him for a year, and he comes back and we go to a restaurant and he ordered vegan. I couldn't believe that he was ordering vegan. I said, what's with the vegan? Because I've been vegan 6 months. So really, when people ask you questions, or they make fun of you, or they, you know, harass you about it, it's simply because they're really curious. Really, really curious. I find that out. I got another friend, Paul Wabosco in Miami. He's same thing. He just bugged me and bugged me and bugged me. And he's become vegan. He's vegan for 4 months, and then he eats a steak and he feels sick. And then he goes back to being vegan again. He'll get it 100% one time.
Let's talk about Let's talk about your story as told in the book In Your Face. It was a great read, and you've had an amazing life. You were on a path to stardom. I mean, you had TV roles, you had film roles, and you sort of changed directions because of the animal issues. It became the focus of your entire life. And I mean, I'm not exaggerating that, right?
No, not at all. And it was a pretty clear delineation for me to make. The one made me a lot of money and notoriety. And when I saw something in a laboratory, the Malamute dog, which I, it's a title of one of the chapters in the book, and it really changed my life. When I saw what went on inside a research facility and the suffering these animals went through, I just said, I got to do something about it. I mean, I just can't just sit by and, go down la la land, making a lot of money and, I was living the good life, but it wasn't fulfilling. Even though I've been a big brother to a lot of kids, I've been a big brother to 26 kids over the years, and it just wasn't fulfilling. So I started to weigh it out, and it did a lot of things for my family. I was able to help my family financially, and my mother in the neighborhood back in Jersey, she would be able to walk down the street and hold her head up high, and everybody to, say hello to her because of I'm on TV, I'm on TV every night. So that was nice. It was good. I'm glad I did it. And it's still, people still pull up things from General Hospital, San Pedro Beach, and all the different things that I've done. And they make a point of it when I am doing some stuff on animals. And, it gives me an open door.
You were on a path to stardom, though. I mean, you had some breaks. You had friends in the industry. You were the gossip columnists are writing about you as and John Travolta as being in the same sort of category as an up and comers. And then so you it wasn't just a casual decision on your part. You gave up a lot to go down this road.
Yeah, I did. I guess you could look at it. I gave it up. But you know what? George, I wouldn't change it for the world. I wanted to make a difference and try to alleviate suffering somewhere, somehow. And the animals needed a voice, and I got a big mouth. So I just figured, let me use it in the right way. In one way it was a sacrifice, but in another way it was a gift. Because, I still live in the same apartment for 47 years. So I didn't change my ways. And I live very frugally and modestly. Some people say you live like a monk. But I don't see anything wrong with that. I just wanted to try to do something, make a change. And after looking at that dog, that Malamute in the face in the laboratory at the VA, I just said, and the dog died in my arms. I just made the dog a promise I would fight this the rest of my life. And I really thought after about 2 years of exposing what went on in laboratories, there would be millions of people that would protest. It never really happened. You're lucky if you get a couple hundred people out there to protest.
Well, let's talk about how you got down this road. One way you got down this road is you got involved in the investigation of a pet theft ring. That's a story you tell in the beginning of this book, In Your Face. Tell us about who these characters were and what you did to go after them and what became of them.
Okay, I got a call in my office one time, and it was that the people thought that their dog was being taken by a very non-reputable person, let's say. And they gave their dog up, but they were smart enough to get the license plate down. And they had called me, and I talked to the person on the phone. Anyway, one thing led to another, and we found that there was a big pet theft ring operating out of the San Fernando Valley. And the way you could tell that is you just go down the streets and you see some posters up all over the place, dogs and, you know, missing reward signs and everything. And then when you see a flurry of those, you know there's a pet theft ring operating in the neighborhood. And so we started investigating it, and we had the people under surveillance, and there were high-speed chases up through Tehachapi Mountains and where they were trying to avoid us. And in one incident, the man and the woman who I was following, they bolted into the LAPD police station. I forget what the division is. It's up in the hills. So the guy comes running out, and he goes, "You're following us. Why are you following us?" And I just started pushing him with my nose. And he runs back into the police station. He's bigger than I am. He runs back into the police station. I walk in the police station, and they said, "That's him. He's the one that's following us." So I said to the sergeant behind the desk, he said, "Are you following these people?" I said, "Yes." And I said, "They've been stealing dogs and selling them for experiments." And he said, "Well, he's got a right to follow you." And I said, and "I'm going to follow you straight to hell." And I did. I made sure I followed them. I busted them 3 or 4 different times. And finally, we got them put in prison. They were the first people, all three of them, first people to ever go to state prison for any animal issue at all. And they got sentenced to over, cumulatively, between the three of them, 14 years, 2 months in state prison. That's never happened before. Nobody's even been sentenced for 2 days in prison for an animal issue. So...
And what was happening was part of the mystery that you unraveled was that people who got into a spot where they had to give their pets away, they'd put an ad in the paper and say, "Looking for a good home for Fido or this cat because I have to move or I've been fired or something like that." And these folks would show up, put on an act. "I've got a great home for them." And they'd take them and put them in kennels and then sell them.
That's it. You know, you got free to good home ads going. And when you do show up and you say, "Well, I want an outdoor dog," well, there's a, you know, "I got an outdoor dog," you know, and, you know, so they say, "Well, that's what we need." And then you say, "Well, I got an indoor dog." "Well, that's what we need." You know, they, no matter what question you have, they have the answer for it. And they're really slick and they're fast. And before you know it, they're walking out with your once beloved companion animal. And it's pretty horrific. And you, when you see these kids crying, you see older people crying and women crying over this, it's pretty horrible. But anyway, when we go after somebody, we get them. I can promise you that we get them. It's not a matter of this, just a matter of when, and it's usually in a short period of time.
Well, you put together a bunch of clues, figured out who these people were and at least some of the places where they lived and operated, and you tracked them down, followed them, confronted them, and eventually put a case together that sent them to prison.
Yes. And, you know, the system moves very slowly when it comes to going after the bad guys. And it moves a lot quicker when it comes to trying to stop us from doing what we have to do. You know, they put laws into place to make that you cannot go into laboratories and investigate what's going on there. And severe, I'm talking about severe penalties, too. And, going after them, it takes, it sure moves real slow.
As you tell in the book, the reason they have an industry like that is because of who pays to buy these dogs and cats and other animals. We're going to get into that, into the vivisection industry right after this. We're talking with Chris DeRose, author of In Your Face. The name of his book is In Your Face, From Actor to Animal Activist. And as I said before, he's a guy who walks the walk. He's put his life, his career, and his freedom on the line for animals and animal causes. And in very dramatic ways, we're going to get into some of the specifics In particular, as we just heard, he tracked down this ring of pet thieves, people who would go around in town. They pay people to steal your dog, your cat out of your yard, or they would trick people into surrendering their pets and telling them that they're going to get a good home. And in fact, what they would do is stick them into boxes and crates and then sell them to these giant labs, university labs, publicly funded labs, where all kinds of horrible experiments were conducted. And that became sort of the focus of Chris's life, is vivisectionists and the horrible things that are done in the name of medical science. We're going to get into that part of the story right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Chris DeRose, in the last segment, you shared with us some of the details about this one particular pet theft ring, these trio of people, despicable people who were doing anything they could to steal people's pets. And then they had three different homes, multiple vehicles, a whole line of BS that they would use to pull this stuff off. You tracked them down. You documented it. You put them under surveillance. You gave the evidence to the authorities, and you confronted them. And then eventually they pulled all kinds of tricks to stay out of trouble, but they were sent to prison. And then you busted them again. But the real discovery
What happened was they after they got busted the first time, they eluded the authorities by moving to the next up to Kern County and got out of L.A. County and moved to Kern County, which is a more rural farming area. And they wound up changing their names to using dead people's identities. And then we had to track them down all over again. And it took about another year and a half to do that, to find them, because they had themselves pretty well hidden. And then they opened up these kennels, all doing the same business all over again. But we managed to find them and get them prosecuted again. It took 3.5 years from the time we started with them to the time that they got sentenced. And I was hoping that the judge, when they were found guilty, I was hoping the judge would give me one good quote, and just say something profound. Well, we got about a half hour of nothing but amazing quotes that these people were in it for money. They weren't in it for any health reasons or beneficial reasons to anybody but themselves. He mentioned that the woman Barbara was the personification of evil, which is one of the chapters in my book. And he just goes on and on and on and on about the callousness and the horrendous conditions that these animals had to live under and what they went through. And these were all people's pets, all people's companion animals. So,
so they would pay criminals to go through the neighborhood and steal dogs and cats. They'd pay them like $10, some little bounty. And the reason that was
correct.
So the reason it worked for them is because somebody else would pay a lot more.
Yes. What happens is these people are what they call USDA Class B licensed dealers, like in B, like in Bravo. They have this license, and they're able to procure animals already in existence. And the way they do that is they'll answer ads. They'll do stuff to themselves. They'll go out and they'll steal the dogs themselves. But when they build up their business, they hire what is called bunchers. And the bunchers go out there, and they get $5 or $10 a dog or a cat. And then they sell them to the bee dealer, licensed by the United States Department of Agriculture. They sell it to these vermin, and they turn around and they sell them for $200-$400 a cat, $600-$800 a dog. It depends on where it is. And this is going back in late 70s, early 80s, that they were doing that. They were making that much money back then on these animals. It's a multi-million-dollar business, and I mean, individuals have made millions until we busted them. This particular crowd, this crew that we busted in Los Angeles, they've expanded in 6 months of operation. They've expanded several times, and they bought 10 acres of land where they were going to build extensive holding pens for these dogs and cats. But we got them before they did that. About 2,000 dogs a year stolen in the United States. I'm sorry, 2 million. And most of those at that time were going to be sold to research facilities. Well, we put the kibosh on that, and we wound up, there were 129 dealers doing this in the United States. Now there's zero. There's still pet theft going on, but it's for other reasons, for breeding facilities, for puppy milling or just to hold them for ransom. So it's still a problem, but it's not nearly the magnitude that it was and as organized as it was at the time.
Well, once you found out who was ultimately paying for these dogs, then your focus shifted to the vivisection industry, medical labs, universities, seemingly respectable organizations supposedly doing research on behalf of humans and health and, saving lives and things of that sort. You start busting into these places. I mean, you make no bones about it. In your book, you say, I've done some illegal things or things on the other side of the law to get to the bottom of this. You go into these places, you created your own organization, you helped other organizations who went in to document the horrors, but once you see what was going on in them, you were really hooked by the kinds of things that were done to these dogs and cats and people's pets.
If most people saw what I saw, you'd be shocked at what it is that it even exists, that it's allowed to exist. And I say the USDA, pet theft is organized crime sanctioned by the USDA. Because they're licensing these people, these garbage bags, they license them to go ahead and steal. And sure, they don't say steal them, but it's the only way you could procure this many animals, and for research and for experiments, and get away with it. So the way they get away with it is it's bad paperwork. It's an infraction. It's a slap on the wrist. It's no jail time. It's not even a penalty. It's not even a fine. They just tell you, okay, you got your bad paperwork, but that covers up the felony crimes of theft and interstate transportation of stolen property. So it's just because it's poor paperwork. So it's camouflaged. These felonies, these crimes are camouflaged by poor paperwork. The USDA knows what's going on. The research facilities know what's going on. We've busted people at Cedars-Sinai, UCLA, many, many, many times for having animals that were people's companion animals. Some of the animals that came in, they still had their dog tags on them. We went head-to-head with the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, which is the second largest government agency next to the Pentagon, and we've gone head-to-head with them, and they lie about it. They just continue and constantly lie about it. And people nowadays are getting more savvy to the government lies and cover-ups and stuff like that. And I'm, having been patriotic and all that all my life, I couldn't believe it. I really resisted, George, going down, and believing all that stuff that the USDA would be crooked or be in bed with the vivisectors. Boy, they are. Let me tell you, they are. And I'm saying that, and nobody's ever sued me on it for the simple reason I could back it all up. And it's a big problem. It's a big, big, big problem.
So what did you see? Dogs, cats, what kind of things were done to them? And what was the premise of why people would be so cruel?
In the laboratories?
Yes, in the labs.
Oh, the first one where that got me started with the Malamute, that was in the VA in Westwood, and that they were doing ulceration tests. At that point, they had been doing the ulceration tests for 39 years. Well, it's about another 39, 40 years have gone by, and they're still doing the same test. And it's excruciatingly painful test where they create an ulcer in the dogs, and they don't give the dogs any analgesics or anything to comfort them. And I went in this one room and saw 12 dogs, and they were in tended to different sections of it. They weren't moving around, walking. They were shaking. They were in agony. And so the last one that we filmed and photographed, this Malamute, I was holding her up in my arms, and she's licking me through the bars. And my partner was photographing it, and the incisions in the stomach were all infected, and it had a catheter tube sticking out. All of them had a catheter tube sticking out. And the incision opened up, and I'm not going to go into the details of what happened, but the dog wound up dying within a couple, 2-3 minutes, and I held the dog in my arms while it died, and I just made a promise to that dog that I would fight this the rest of my life. And that's just one of the things. And then in the bee dealer camps where these people that are licensed by the United States Department of Agriculture, and by the way, that's just a shield for biomedical research, the research facilities. They say, oh, you see, we have the diploma up here on the wall, and they're so proud of it, saying that they're they get their dogs and their cats from bona fide USDA licensed Class B dealers. And they're the biggest crooks and thieves in the world. And the USDA knows about it, the biomedical research, the research facilities, the universities, the hospitals, they all know about it. We busted them over and over and over and over and over again. And then, you know, there have been liberations that have taken place inside their laboratories where the animals have been taken out. So, you know, one time at UCLA, we went to go inside, and I was with Jack Colon, and we went to go inside the facility, and we were inside, and it was they had the cats tied down, their legs were stretched out, tied with rope, and a piece of rope going through the mouth, and just drawn and quartered, just laying there. And the students are getting ready to do the experiments on him. And Jack and I just walked in, and he said he was a scientist, and he wanted to know what was going on there. And until they finally realized who we were, because we started becoming more assertive about what they were doing and letting the students know it's unnecessary and painful. Until then, they let us stay. But when they figured out who we were, they had us escorted out. But here were the cats. Well, there was about 8 of them stretched out, and there's about 4 students per cat getting ready to vivisect the cat while it's alive. So, and that's why they had them tied down the way they had them tied down, so they don't move around. There's a thing called stereotaxic devices, which you've seen these devices where it's got two sharp edges that go out. These go into the eyes of the animal, and the another one in the spine, another one in the jaw and the face, and then two going by the ears. And this holds the animal down while they're experimenting on the animal, the dog, the cat, the rabbit, whatever animal it is. It's holds them down while they're cutting them or doing electrodes or whatever type of experiment they're doing, chemical experiments, skin tests, whatever. And it keeps them from moving around very much because you have these sharp things in there, and they're going into their eyes and into their ears, and they call stereotaxic devices. It's something that's primeval, and you wouldn't think something like that even exists today, but it does. It goes on in these laboratories, and that's just so that they can experiment on these animals without giving them analgesics.
You found ways to slip into these labs. I mean, you're not use a blowtorch to burglarize them or kicking in the doors necessarily, but you would slide in and collect information, get photos, things of that sort. One of the early labs that you went into, you tell the story in the book, a bunch of dogs are in there. You're kind of worried that these dogs are going to bark and make noise, and there's no noise. You go in, and there's no noise from the dogs. They're not barking at you, and you found out why.
Yeah, well, depending on which facility we're talking about. In one case, the dogs have been debarked. But
I mean, their vocal cords are cut, right?
Yes, yes, yes. It's just a nice way of saying it. Yeah, they just cut them. And then at Cedar Sinai, they had a guy named Anthony Punnett. He was from South America, big, big guy. And he came to our office one time, and he was telling us, because the day before, City of Hope, we busted them and for getting dogs from San Bernardino Animal Shelter. And they're saying that they don't debark the dogs there. And he came to my office, and then we got him on the news, and he said, if this is what they see, very humble guy, and very, very humble, and only had a sixth grade education. He said, if they're saying that they don't cut the vocal cords, they're lying. And I tell them to their face, they're lying, because I'm the one that does it. And I've had a sixth grade education. And so here you have a guy that's working for them. And of course they fired him, and he needed the job. He had a wife and a kid, and it's not going to be easy for a guy from South America with a sixth grade education to get a job, but his conscience told him it was the right thing to do.
And they're debarking them because so that the researchers don't have to hear the shrieks and screams of and pain and agony of the animals while they're working on it.
That's right. That's exactly the reason. It's the only reason that they do it, because these animals scream, and they, you know, it would be like having a child or a person being strapped down and they're screaming, please don't do it, please, it hurts, it hurts. Well, it's the same thing what these animals go through, except they cries, and that's what they do. They just cut the vocal cords, and they go down there, and they don't do it in any particular professional way. They have a guy that doesn't even know how to do it, doing it.
We're talking with Chris DeRose. We're talking with Chris DeRose about his book, In Your Face, From Actor to Animal Activist. In the next segment, we're going to get into how he was sent away for a while, sent into a very dark place with some bad people, and also how he got shot in the back, literally and figuratively. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast.